those of WEFTA Board of Directors, Associate Station Manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
Stay tuned for an interview with Paula Kluth, author and advocate for school inclusion, on her new book, All In, 18 Ways to Create Inclusive Virtual Classrooms. But first, disability news for the week of November 30th, 2020. Government investigators are sharing details about how schools are addressing the needs of students with disabilities since ending in-person classes at the start of the pandemic. The Government Accountability Office released a report that examines how schools manage special education and services during the switch to distance learning in the spring of the 2019-2020 academic year, finding that they have struggled. They conducted the investigation as part of GAO's oversight responsibilities under the CARES Act, a federal COVID-19 relief package passed earlier this year. For the report, government investigators review distance learning plans from 15 school districts that have high proportions of either students with disabilities or English learners. Officials with several districts were interviewed, as were advocates, researchers, school administrators, and other service providers. Investigators found various factors that complicated the delivery of special education services during distance learning, the wide range of needs among students with disabilities, and the variety of services needed in their individual education programs posed a challenge. Also, the ability of parents and caregivers to help students with disabilities played a role. The GAO noted that delivering services such as occupational therapy, physical therapy, or speech therapy for students with complex needs were difficult to do remotely. School officials told investigators that they could meet some challenges by altering instruction, having virtual meetings with parents, and promoting more collaboration between educators and with families. Sometimes they said that children's goals and services were modified through temporary distance learning plans. In the interim, advocates told government investigators that, quote, providing students with the services they need remains an ongoing challenge, end quote. The COVID-19 pandemic has led to a backlog of about 300,000 new disability claims at the Department of Veterans Affairs, according to the head of the Veterans Benefits Administration last week. VBA Chief Paul Lawrence said, quote, we've got to get this backlog down. We're really trying hard to figure this out, end quote. By last November, the department had processed claims at a high rate and brought the backlog down to an all-time low of 64,000 cases in March of 2013. The backlog of new disability claims at the VA had reached a peak of 611,000. In 2020, the number of backlog claims increased slightly to 70,000 as COVID restrictions were imposed across the government in erasing all progress made by the VA in processing the new claims. On April 1st, the VA announced that, quote, as concerns about COVID-19 infections increased and the president declared a national emergency, VA suspended its in-person medical disability examinations for its compensation and pension, or C&P, programs, end quote. The VA did not restart in-person exams until late August, and then only sporadically. Also, COVID-19 restrictions at the National Archives Warehouse limited the access to records needed to verify veterans' claims. Encouragingly, the increase in backlog new cases appears to have leveled off in recent weeks, Lawrence said. Quote, we're processing at about the same rate we're receiving. Now we're looking forward to the fall and beyond when we can drive it back down, end quote. People with disabilities receiving supplemental security income and other Social Security benefits will soon see their payments rise a whopping 1.3% in 2021. The change comes as a result of an annual automatic cost of living adjustment known as COLA that's tied to inflation. By law, Social Security benefits go up when there is an increase in the Consumer Price Index from the U.S. Department of Labor's Bureau of Labor Statistics. Higher payments payments will begin December 31st for over 8 million SSI beneficiaries and in January 2021 for over 64 million people across the country receiving Social Security. For individuals receiving SSI, the maximum federal payment will grow from $783 per month this year to $794 per month in 2021 with the automatic adjustment. Couples will see $1,191 per month next year, up from $1,175. Some states kick in additional money for SSI beneficiaries, so actual payments may be higher. And finally, a bit of controversy is following a new film by Australian singer-songwriter Sia with the release of her new film, Music. The film features actor Maddie Ziegler as a teen with autism, a disability that Ziegler does not have. In a post on Twitter, Irish actress Brona Waugh said, quote, "Sia, can I ask why you didn't cast a disabled actor for this part? It's pretty offensive the way you've chosen to portray this character," end quote. Twitter amplified the outcry as the controversy began to trend in the U.S. with actors, activists, organizations, and fans chiming in. Some were offended by Sia's choice to cast Ziegler, who does not have a disability, while others condemned the singer's use of the organization Autism Speaks to consult on the project. Autism Speaks bills itself as an autism advocacy organization, but it has come under fire for not being founded or led by people with autism. In response, actress Francesca Ramsey said, quote, "The purpose of a movie trailer is to spark interest in a film. It's obvious you put a lot of work into this project and are incredibly talented, but you missed the mark here. People are allowed to feel however they want to about the work, but especially when you take it upon yourself to tell the story of an underrepresented and often misrepresented community, the least you could do is include and consult them. Otherwise, are you really advocating for them?" End quote. And that's the news for this week.
Nothing about us without us. Whoa. Nothing about us without us. What about free energy and technology and mobility? What about free journalism and free opinion for everyone? And if you say nothing else matters, I understand what you feel.
And you are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM. This is Disability Beat. I'm Vicki Nicewander, joined today on the phone by Paula Kluth, who was on the show ages ago, but has done a lot since. So I'm really glad to have you back, Paula.
Thank you so much for having me, Vicki. I'm really excited to be here.
So why don't we start by having you introduce yourself to the listeners, let them know who you are and kind of what you've spent your life doing.
Sure. Well, I am first and foremost a school teacher. I started my career as a special education teacher, and I'm K-12 certified, and I've worked in with young children, and I've worked in high school as well. And later as sort of a coach and an inclusion facilitator. And my most recent sort of employment outside of doing this work on my own has been with as a professor. So most recently at Syracuse University doing teacher education. But for the last several years, over a decade now, I have worked in-service education. So I've been working with teachers, not folks who are becoming teachers, but folks who are already teachers. So I work a lot with school systems, and I work with, family groups, and I work with individual educators, and all for this same, this one goal of inclusive education and really thinking about inclusion very broadly, how to support all learners in curriculum instruction, and today, in the world that we're in today, just helping all learners to feel like that sense of community when we're not in the same space.
Yeah, and we're going to get to the whole idea of the virtual programming in a bit. I just must ask you, though, How did you arrive as a trained teacher? What brought you to the world of school inclusion? Because it's not that common.
Yeah, I mean, I wish in all the years since I've been with you, Vicki, I wish we could both say that there's been these leaps and bounds. But there is growth and there is movement. But my journey actually starts before. And I for years, it took somebody asking me this question in an interview for me to really, you know, bring it forward in other contexts, like in a teacher ed, which is that I went to a high school that made some, I won't say that it was inclusive, but I'm 50 years old, so way back in the late 80s, my high school was bringing kids from a self-contained sort of a special school that was, you know, a public school in my district. They brought them to the home school, to their home school, so the schools that they would attend if they did not have disabilities. And I made my first friends with disabilities when I was a senior in high school, and I became very interested in disability in general. I was really encouraged by teachers in my school and by these new friends. And so all of that to say, you know, I talk, especially when I talk to families, I will talk about, you know, what an impact. I'm sure that was really a risk for a lot of those families and feeling what it was, you know, what they were being asked to do in send their children to new schools. But what a gift it was to that school community that, you know, my school, my friends, we got to learn in this diverse community, and it clearly had a big impact on me. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's the curriculum, and then there's the hidden curriculum. What are students learning in your school about difference and disability? And it wasn't perfect. It was the late 80s. I mean, it wasn't essentially evolved in all the ways that we would hope, but it was a start. And I'm not the only person. I happen to know that this, that this really impacted in a positive way. So, so it matters. It matters in sort of these, you know, the ways that we talk about today for students, and we think about all the potential academic benefits, and we think about social and emotional benefits, and we think about, you know, benefits in just having this community and access to these resources that are also diverse. But, a lot of people have stories, positive and negative, about what they remember about disability, you know, in their childhood and their mm-hmm. teen years. And, when you don't have those experiences every single day, that's a shame. It's a shame for all kids when they don't grow up in this way. So for me, obviously, big influence. And I have a lot of gratitude for those friends and for those families and for my teachers.
You have done an awful lot of work in the field in this regard and have written, how many books have you written over the years now?
More than a dozen for sure. I've written more recently some books for kids, so we might not count those as the same kind of material, but I wrote a book last Christmas about a little doggy with wheels because I love rescue animals. Mm. I love that, the element of just thinking about the power of all. So I won't give away anything about the ending, but actually it's free on YouTube, so people can check that out. I have a free reading on there. But for teachers, for these kinds of audiences, about, 12, 13, or 14, something like that.
Yeah, and your most recent book about creating inclusive virtual classrooms, did you just slam this together in the last 5 months, or has this been in the works for a while?
Definitely. This book was slammed together for sure, and you can tell because 18 is sort of an odd number of recommendations to give. As my colleague who's a designer said, it's not done, but it's due.
But it had to be done by somebody, because this is exactly what families and teachers are looking for right now.
Yeah, 100%, Vicki. It was that what I was saying to you in that sort of our pre-show conversation was, like a lot of educators and families, I was panicked in March and April, May. But then I also thought things will be better by the fall. And I think a lot of people thought that. So I didn't start writing. I was doing other things. I was trying to help, talk to teachers. I was trying to work in classrooms when possible. And then when we came back to school and it was clear this would continue, so I didn't start writing until after summer. I wish I had started. And what I did was I just did a scramble to contact all the, you know, if there were parents that I had seen on, you know, on social media or teachers that I was working with currently. It just, you know, just tried to collect as many stories as possible. How are you keeping inclusion at the center of everything? Because, you know, inclusion's never been harder in a sense, but it's also never been more critical. There's many contributors to this book, so I just want to give a shout out to all the folks that influenced this, including disabled children themselves, people that just were very generous in coming on board and saying, here's one thing you can try.
Yeah. And I know, you know, we're kind of separating out inclusion as, you know, a goal of the book from actual education. I know a lot of families are struggling with the idea that their children with, especially those with significant disabilities, cannot benefit from education online, that the virtual classroom is ineffective. Do you have any opinion or experience with that at all?
Yes. The idea that there are some kids who cannot benefit really was at the heart of even starting this project. And I will be very honest in saying it was not something that I, you know, it was not my own light bulb moment that brought this forward, but I was watching a video online of a teacher named Sarah Brady, someone sent me, and she's a teacher in California who was doing a virtual lunch table for a young man with really complex support needs and some friends in their inclusive school. And it was just so well done, so compelling how, you know, and obviously this child, Finn's mother, was very much involved in him participating, but it had a dual purpose. Not only, again, was early on was Sarah, you know, bringing kids together for the sense of community, but she was also using that opportunity to work on Finn's communication goals. She was teaching him how to use a really complex dynamic system, augmentative communication system.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so beautifully done. And what struck me, going back to your question about how I got involved, what really struck me was these four kids in the video, how in March and April, how much they probably were all missing routine and their teachers. And these lucky kids, all of them, got to be with Sarah a couple times a week and just talk and be with a teacher.
Mm.
And I thought to myself, that is not just some kids who need that. All kids, in particular right now, really need these caring adults in their lives. And they all got to be with Sarah, who's a very cool and, you know, caring and pretty amazing teacher. And so that was definitely a catalyst. The other part of the book that deals with this, and again, the book is small. There's, you know, it's 18 ideas. Each idea is a few pages. So each sort of little chapter, if you will, is just, you know, a couple of, you know, go and do it. Try this. And one of the ideas in the, one of the final ideas is called Try Plan B. And that was written with some colleagues of mine who all of us have a background in complex support needs and significant disability. So we take on that idea. What do you do when the family cannot help at all, like Finn's mother, which is a reality for so many? What do you do when they're not going to be able to sit at the computer and help with a response to even a well-crafted question?
Mm-hmm.
And so some of the ideas that we provide are, you know, for some, we're going to have to work really carefully, really very frequently with a family to outline all the IEP objectives and to brainstorm continuously, how can we just pull those IEP objectives into your daily life? Let us help you. Let us see if any of the supports, let's just brainstorm any support that we may be able to offer. And let us help you, you know, bring in some of these objectives into chores, into mealtime. And other ideas were sort of what we call flipping the goal, where we would take the example in the book is a social studies teacher, a child who was included in a high school class, and no longer could the family support her to access lessons. Even if you've got great teachers who want to adapt it, you'd have to have so much at home for kids that for some kids to be able to just have that adult nearby to engage. So this family said, we're out. We can't do those things. And the school said, well, what if we had some experiences that relate to our content, And it could spur conversation and you could have shared experiences. So he sent home a list of movies that were family films that were all related to, I think the first example was women's history, women's roles in history. And so you could watch any of these films. You could watch Whale Rider. You could watch League of Their Own. You could watch, Norma Rae, different films, and said, you know, and these might spur conversations. And the family was so impressed by that and gave such great feedback and said, you know, we have been watching more movies. That's something that we might do anyway. And prompting the teacher then to give those lists to all kids, saying for a lot of families, those things are helpful to just to say, here's, you know, what kinds of audiobooks might we listen to when we're just, you know, we're hanging out around the house or we're doing our chores and things like that. These are all fourth grade books that we might be reading. Give families, they're not going to be able to address goals. Give them experiences and activity ideas that might fit well into their day, but also have some sort of level of, you know, some connection to standards-based content that it makes it easy. Kids can have some of those, a tether to what other learners, what other students are learning. And also just draw the attention to the team that other students may need those things as well.
Right. And I think I have no experience with this at all because my daughter is now out of school and has been for a long time. But I do have experience with her participating in Zoom meetings with friends, and she's in a choir and they're having Zoom meetings once a week. And I find, and I think it's probably true, that a lot of folks with disabilities find it easier to communicate through a visual medium like Zoom as opposed to face-to-face. Like, you know, somebody with autism, for instance, it gives them a lot more control over their environment. They can mute themselves. They can, you know, do all those things that, you know, or mute the screen if they want to. They can do those things that give them more control. Have you experienced that as well?
Vicki, that is one of the reasons I really wanted to write about it. And I write about that in the introduction to the book. While trying hard not to sound like this is easy, because nobody would say that, but one of my first thoughts after panicking was exactly what you just said. My goodness, this could create opportunities now and in the future. What if a student, for example, in the accommodation section of the book, I give a link for a virtual sensory website. I created a virtual sensory room, and mm-hmm. a lot of schools and teachers are doing this. And I thought, what if some kids don't need to leave the classroom anymore? You know, not only virtually, but in the future, because they can put their headphones on and access a virtual sensory room. What if during these lessons we are accepting kids being able to type in the chat, hold up a sign, unmute themselves and speak, use a signal? What if that universal design, those UDL supports, translate back into the classroom and we realize everybody may want to respond and behave differently as a way to show what they have learned? And then to your point, how can we think differently about in the future, those ideas that, you know, somebody doesn't necessarily have to engage in the same way as somebody else. And like you said, you can mute yourself if you need that break. You can. I also thought about folks who, needed just a simple accommodation of just turn off my camera. Or one young man said, I don't want to look at all the people staring back at me, but if I can just sit to the side, if I don't have to be on camera, I'm okay. And it just got me thinking about all of those different ways that this could be easier, where kids might invent their own ways, you know, of being in the space, or you could enter or exit a room more comfortably. I even thought about at the break that's coming up for trying new classes. I mean, you were the parent of a high schooler, and I think a lot of times we get stuck in a rut in high school about kids, you know, certain kids with disabilities. And I will say, I do use both person first language and identity for, I kind of go back and forth mm-hmm. to honor different communities. So let me just say that, you know, a lot of kids with disabilities, they may go into the same kinds of electives every year in some high schools, so we get stuck in a rut. And I was, you know, one of the suggestions is let kids try a lot of different electives. As you said, Vicki, go in and out, sample some. That mm-hmm. would be harder to do you know, when we are not virtual. But perhaps this semester, we could actually, you know, just kind of sit in on some of these classes for a few minutes, see if that teacher's style works for us, and then very quietly, you know, enter and exit into other classes and sample these different classes. Those kinds of things may be some benefits.
Yeah,
to this new way of learning.
It sounds great. And my own daughter, who never checked her email before COVID, now can go to her email, find the link to the meeting, click on it, manage the Zoom account like a pro. And this is a skill that's going to benefit her for her life. So yeah, this is not a good situation for kids, but there might be some benefit that comes from it.
Yeah, I think even things like, and again, we're not going to be in this forever, as you point out, but really we try to point out things that we're doing now that keep doing them later, you know, that we want to encourage folks to do later. So, you know, teaching those skills, taking the time to really, you know, self-determination, help folks learn those skills, asking kids, how do you learn best, and giving them all this menu of ideas. And then when they get back to the face-to-face, they'll be familiar with having those kinds of conversations. Even something like, you know, seeing kids who are now able to, I was just working with in a classroom not that maybe I think it was last week, and you know we were asking kids to just you know what are all of the ways in which you want to engage in these breakout rooms. You know what will that look and feel like? And students were really good. They were saying, I like it better when I can be with the same people over and over again. Or can I turn my camera off but still participate? And you know really even thinking about those dynamics that can be challenging for kids. So I just love that idea that we're being, I think, a little bit more flexible, and I hope that carries over, you know, and I think we're also being, I think it's because we have to, because kids have to be at the center here. I think we're focusing a lot on that self-determination, kids as agents, not just making choices, but learning new skills.
Yeah, and becoming better self-advocates as a result.
Yeah.
What was the most surprising thing that you learned by doing the research for this book?
It's a good question. I would say, you know, very well, I'll start with saying exactly what you just talked about. That was, I don't know if it was, it got more and more surprising as we went to see some of these potential benefits. For example, there are some kids we're never going to get back, and I'm trying to be okay with that. In other words, there are some kids, on the autism spectrum who are finding the sleep schedule so much, that works so much better for them, that they're not getting up many, many transitions. So there are some kids where I think that I kept hearing, oh, my child has high anxiety and he's really liking this. So I think about that in two ways. One is, okay, can it be okay for some, can we have hybrid models? I think we will. Mm-hmm. I think that's not going away. I think that's going to be something we'll carry in. But that not so much that we give up on what face-to-face instruction can look like. So I was surprised by both how many, you know, I wasn't surprised by how many kids struggled so much, but I was surprised by how many and which kids actually did okay and some that did really well. And that made me sad. It made me sad. There were some things that were, again, some kids having better sleep schedules and sleeping in. That's you know, that's understandable.
Mm-hmm.
But kids who felt like their anxiety came down so much because they hate being at school, that's heartbreaking as a teacher.
Yeah. So where can people buy the book, Paula?
So you can get the book on Amazon. It's self-published, and again, kind of I said, you know, put together in just that few months' time. So we just uploaded it to Amazon.com, and they can if they want to see a little bit about. I think there's right up right now. There's like one little review up there. You can see a little snippet there. But I think some of the examples that I've shared here in the phone call, if you're looking for more flavor, those are the kinds of illustrations. Those are the kinds of things that you will see.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us. We're out of time, but I'm so glad you could be on the show today. The book is All In, 18 Ways to Create Inclusive Virtual Classrooms. Thanks, Paula Kluth.
Thank you, Vicki. It was really nice being here.
This and other episodes of Disability Beat are available at weft.org/public affairs. For updates and information, join our Facebook page at Disability Beat Radio. To share ideas for guests or topics, email Vicki at disabilitybeat@gmail.com. Thanks for tuning in and have a great rest of your week. No, I'm staying.